Herzlich willkommen bei Klinisch Relevant, deinem Wissenspartner für das Gesundheitswesen. Dreimal pro Woche, nämlich dienstags, donnerstags und samstags, versorgen wir dich mit unserem Podcast und bringen dir Fachwissen in deine klinische Praxis. Weitere Informationen und Angebote findest du auf unserer Webseite www.klinisch-relevant.de. Heute hörst du einen Podcast in englischer Sprache. Laura Reynolds aus dem Klinisch Relevant Team spricht heute mit Privatdozent Dr. Thomas Spahn über Infektionen mit Clostridium difficile. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
Hey, real quick before we start the episode, I just want to let you know that I'm giving a medical English course on Saturday the 16th of November. It's live, online and very interactive. You can buy tickets over the Klinisch Relevant website. Maybe you have contact with English-speaking patients or maybe you're planning a trip abroad. Then this is the course for you. Hope to see you there. Hello and welcome to another Klinisch Relevant podcast episode in English. My name is Laura Reynolds and today I'm very excited to have Dr. Thomas Spahn, who is the Chefarzt of Innere Medizin in Marien Krankenhaus in Schwerte. And we're going to be talking about the topic Clostridioides difficile. So welcome, and if you'd like to tell us a bit about yourself.
Is it okay if I say Laura?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay. You might say Thomas as well, so okay. I think that's more familiar.
Okay
so yeah. That's easier. So thank you for having me on your show, yeah. On your podcast. I'm Thomas Spahn. I'm the head of the Department of Internal Medicine at Marien Krankenhaus Schwerte. I've been working there for some 16 years now, and I'm very happy to do this talk with you, as I am generally very interested in all kinds of medical education. So I'm a member of the faculty of the University of Münster Medical School. So what is my special interest by training? I'm a gastroenterologist, and I'm studied medicine in Mainz University, close to Frankfurt, and where I also did the first 18 months of my internship. Then I received a fellowship from the German Research Council, and I actually went to become a research fellow at Brigham Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School from 95 to 98. Where I did a lot of basic research on immune regulation, animal models of autoimmunity, especially in multiple sclerosis, gut-associated immune system. And from there on, I went to Münster, where I finished my internship, and my residency in internal medicine became specialized in internal medicine afterwards in gastroenterology, and where I kind of received my academic degree. So I'm an associate professor of internal medicine. After being attending in Osnabrück, it's in the northern Germany, Lower Saxonia, where I worked for 4 years, I joined the Marien Hospital in Schwerte, where I've been working ever since 2008. The hospital is a kind of hospital which serves all different kinds of medical needs. It's the general, it's a kind of a general hospital, and the department is a department of general internal medicine. So we treat about 4,000 in-house patients a year, with all different kinds of disease, ranging from gastroenterology to pulmonary disease, heart disease, oncological patients. So it's a very a diversified spectrum of patients, and so it's a very interesting job to do. And I enjoy it very much, and I spent most of my time actually doing endoscopic examinations. And for the last 4 years, I've also been like the speaker of the physicians in chief of the hospital. So I'm kind of also getting more involved in medical politics, which is also very interesting at the moment.
Yeah, that is a very interesting career thus far. And yes, endoscopy, that is where we have met. So I do, yeah, and you gave a talk on this topic, Clostridioides, recently. So I found it really interesting. So I'm really grateful to have you on the show today telling us all about it. Well, I think the first thing to talk about is the name, Clostridioides. Maybe our listeners are listening right now and thinking, what are they talking about? It's Clostridium. Why are they calling it something different? Are you able to tell us a bit about that, the name change?
I think the change of the name is scientifically arbitrary.
Yeah.
I'm not a microbiologist, so I'm not too familiar with the background of the decision, but I guess some scientific committee which has spent a lot of time on research and on this strain of bacteria found out that actually this name is closer to truth than the name they had before. So they changed the name from Clostridius to Clostridioides, which is actually even more difficult to pronounce. I think this is just some scientific committee who found out that this is probably, in terms of taxonomy, closer to the roots where the bacteria actually come from.
Yeah. That's very correct. For preparing for this podcast episode, I researched it because I was also wondering where did the name change come from? And there is a Lancet article from 2019, and there was a really interesting piece where they said it actually would now belong to the family Peptostreptococci, but that name is obviously very difficult to say. And also because not just in the medical field, but outside the medical field, people know Clostridium. So it would have been a marketing nightmare to change it, because in English it's known as C. diff and people just know that. So they had to change the name where it would still start with a C so that it wouldn't change in any other field either, which I found that very interesting, that there was so much thought clearly that went into this, how it should be renamed. Does it change anything? No, not really. No. But fun facts. So what is, we'll call it C. diff because I think that's the easiest way to refer to it. What can you tell us about it? I suppose, who gets it? What's the epidemiology? What's so special about it? Why should anyone listening right now, why should they care about it?
In general terms, the special interest is that C. diff is very common. And then if you're working in a hospital, it's a kind of a general threat to everybody who's being treated in hospital. Being so very common also means that the human gut has a very close relationship to C. diff, in terms that in newborn babies, and in the first year of life, nearly 80 to 100% of the babies actually are kind of infected with C. diff. However, they don't have disease. So as there is probably no receptor for the toxins, and as life goes on and babies grow older and children grow older, the rate of infection actually, colonization is probably the right word, the rate of colonization goes down. And so it is much lower in adults. However, I think it's like 5 to 10%. However, if you're admitted to a hospital, your likeliness to have a colonization is up to 20%. And among with rotaviruses, and other viral causes of dysenteria, it's like one of the top causes of hospital infections. That's probably the significance. And the other significance is causes diarrhea and as a certain tropism to people who have a weak immune system. So the elderly, the people who undergo dialysis, transplant patients, they're very prone to get not only colonized but infected and suffer from diarrhea.
Mm-hmm. And apart from diarrhea, are there any other symptoms that patients could have?
Fever, chills, and there are some certain severe symptoms, like you might actually develop a toxic megacolon. So your large intestine kind of loads up to an extent where it might actually explode or blast. And you ultimately need to undergo emergency surgery to prevent you from dying of this complication. And it might go along with renal impairment. And but this is like only a very small subgroup of patients. Most people just get diarrhea. And some people get a fever. And you might have an elevated white blood count and CRP.
Okay.
Might go up.
What is like the definition of having a C. diff infection? Or if someone in hospital gets diarrhea, who should we be testing? Everyone in the hospital, or is it just people in hospital, or is it, say, if a patient, you know, in the community has diarrhea and comes to hospital, should we be thinking about C. diff, or is it mainly just patients in hospital already?
It is very common in hospitalized patients. So everybody who within the first 3 days of admission gets diarrhea should be considered a candidate to have C. diff infection, or CDI is the other abbreviation, which is very familiar. Okay. The other candidates are norovirus infections or rotavirus infections. And you should be very careful and should scrutinize all the patients who have been under antibiotic treatment, as we know it's also called antibiotic-associated diarrhea. It's like one of the most common causes of antibiotic-associated diarrhea. As we know that C. diff actually changes the milieu or the total situation for bacteria in the large intestine, that undergoing antibiotic treatment favors the growth of C. diff in the human large intestine.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the diagnosis, we send away a stool sample into the lab. And I was wondering if you'd be able to explain this. So sometimes we'll get the result back and it will say C. diff positive, PCR result to follow. And I hear, oh yeah, they're C. diff positive, but we're waiting to see about the toxins. What does this mean? Do you know what this means? Like that this initial positive result, but then they could either be toxin positive or toxin negative?
As with most bacterial infections, I think we should differentiate between colonization and infection. So if you screened the stool of, let's say, 100 inhabitants of our hometown, you would probably find C. diff bacteria in a significant amount of samples. However, you should always be aware, what's the percentage of these people who host C. diff who actually suffer from disease? So not every bug, not every bacteria which is detected necessarily means that people suffer from infection. So most of the cases are just colonization. So we should always be very aware of this, that they are, with certain exemptions, the presence of certain bacteria in samples doesn't necessarily mean that you are suffering from the disease. It means just that the bacterium is there. We should talk about infection if there are clinical signs and symptoms like diarrhea, fever, weakness and so on. Mm-hmm. Dehydration.
Yeah, yeah. What is the therapy for it?
Yeah. It's very straightforward. There's three antibiotics. There's metronidazole, which has been the mainstay for the treatment. There's vancomycin, and there's thioidazomycin. Unfortunately, like with many other bacteria, the resistance against metronidazole, which is commonly available and cheap, has gone up. So metronidazole might be used, but if it's ineffective, you shouldn't use it any longer. And if you have patients who are at risk of developing severe C. diff infection, you shouldn't treat them with metronidazole because the risk of ineffectiveness is too high. So we still have vancomycin, which should be orally administered, like 4 times 250 milligrams. Until the clinical symptoms go away. And you have thioidazomycin, which is the youngest of those available antibiotics, and which is has the lowest rate of resistance as of now, which I think the patent is still pending for thioidazomycin, so it's the most expensive treatment too. But however, I think choosing your treatment depends on the personal risk of your patient of developing a severe course of infection. And so you might start off with vancomycin. And the question is like, is the patient elderly? Is the patient under immunosuppression? Is the patient under dialysis? So that's the questions you have to ask before you choose your treatment.
Yeah. I think that's a really important, I suppose, take-home message. There are guidelines out there. They're the S2 Leitlinie Gastrointestinale Infektionen der Deutschen Gesellschaft für Gastroenterologie, Verdauungs- und Stoffwechselkrankheiten. And that's from November 2023. So they're pretty
fresh.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And I think most people maybe listening will still have it in their head, C. diff, metronidazole. And as you mentioned, the people who are more at risk for getting C. diff are also those people who are more at risk for getting a severe infection and also getting a recurrence of C. diff. So that means they fail their treatment. So these are people, like you mentioned, the elderly with comorbidities such as immunosuppression or dialysis. So it is not in the recommendations to give these people metronidazole, but to start straight away with vancomycin, or if you really have a very high suspicion that they are at risk of getting a recurrence, it says you could also start with fidaxomicin. I hope I pronounced that right.
That's a hard one.
Yeah, it is. So I think, as I said, for the listeners, I think that's an important take-home message. Because I also think I feel like I'm biased. I work in geriatrics, so there's a high proportion. I'd see
just elderly patients, right?
Yes. Elderly patients.
Naturally.
Yes. So I'd see a lot more C. diff maybe than the normal person, or we hold on to patients for longer maybe than on an acute ward. So we are the people who will see the recurrence of the C. diff. So they might have had C. diff already in their previous hospital, were treated with maybe vancomycin, and then we will see them and they'll have another recurrence. So just something to keep in mind when you're choosing your antibiotics. But also, as there is the antibiotic treatment, when would you start the antibiotic treatment?
It depends on the risk situation of the patient you're looking at. If you have a younger patient who's otherwise free of additional symptoms except for diarrhea and who is in good shape, you might just go and send off some stool samples and check out what's really happening, because not every type of diarrhea is actually C. diff induced. However, if you have a patient who is elderly, who's immunosuppressed and who is at hazard of really developing a severe cause of disease with the diarrhea should start as early as possible. Ideally, you should send off the stool samples before starting the treatment. However, if you're in an outpatient setting, I would, if the patient has undergone a course of antibiotic treatment before, I would probably also start blindly. You're kind of concerned that any delay might be hazardous for the patient. Ideally, you send off the stool sample and then you start treatment in a patient who's at risk of developing severe disease.
Cool. And yeah, if the stool sample comes back negative, you can always stop the therapy. And so we have the antibiotic therapy, but I guess we will also have to do some supportive therapy because they're probably losing a lot.
Well, you have to make sure that the patient doesn't suffer from dehydration, that nutrition is safeguarded. Especially in these elderly patients, if they have diarrhea, they kind of stop eating and drinking by themselves. So maybe you have to do a total parenteral nutrition. You have to watch these patients very carefully just to make sure they don't undergo renal failure or develop toxic medical colon.
Are there any other treatments? Maybe monoclonal antibodies.
I think this is a very interesting aspect as with the increasing body of evidence we have from research, we kind of get a better understanding of the real pathophysiology of these diseases. So there's been two monoclonal antibodies developed against the toxin A and the toxin B. And to cut a long story short, the monoclonal antibody against the B toxin, it's called like B betzlotoxumab, very difficult name, betzlotoxumab, but starts with a B, so it's easier to memorize. It's against the B toxin. This monoclonal antibody has been shown to be effective in the prevention of relapses. However, it is not advised to take this give this monoclonal antibody the primary treatment of acute infection. So just if you had a single course and you have a relapse, then the antibody actually works. And I think it's very interesting to see that you have the two toxins, but the treatment with the antibody against A doesn't improve the course of the disease if you combine it with the betzlotoxumab. Single treatment with betzlotoxumab is effective in preventing relapses at a significant rate, about 40%.
And presumably that is also a very expensive therapy. And
I think a single shot and it's about $4,000 or 4,000 euros in an area.
Is it available here in Germany?
It can only be provided by international pharmacies. However, if you really request it, it's available at international pharmacy.
I wanted to ask you as well about fecal microbiota transplant. What can you tell us about that?
This is also a very, very interesting aspect in terms that infection with Clostridioides tells us a lot about how the immune system and the bacteria work in the gut and the large intestine. There's been a number of studies published, and to cut a long story short, fecal microbiome transplantation, FMT, is advised in prevention of relapse. It's not advised in primary treatment, and it's very effective. However, it has the gaze or the all the complexities and the difficulties of experimental treatment. Why do I say this? Because to my knowledge, at least in Europe, there are no standardized medical applications of drug applications of FMT, so that you buy a tablet or a pill or whatsoever. To my knowledge, in the United States, you can actually buy a standardized product, which is frozen, and you have to thaw it, and then you have to drink it. Whereas in Europe, clinical studies on FMT and inflammatory bowel disease are currently performed. I'm very much interested to see what's coming out. And so if you're talking about chemotherapy, drug therapy, you usually have a standardized product where you say, like, you take aspirin, it's 100 milligrams, and every tablet of aspirin contains the same, and it's a safe medication because it's been tested, and the way it's produced, and it's standardized. And however, then with the FMT, you have to gain the feces of certain individuals who checked before, and the checklist is very long. Basically, you have to rule out a number of infections which might be harmful for a recipient of the transplant, and then you can apply the FMT by endoscopic route to the upper GI tract, so you can kind of basically use a huge syringe. And usually they have like 60 milliliters of the FMT fluid, and you irrigate into the small intestine. Or you can also apply it to the large intestine by a colonoscopy procedure, or you could use it as an enema. And to my knowledge, the best effectiveness is if you do it through the small intestinal or the colonic route. Whereas for the patient, it's probably the best way to do it through the small intestine, because you don't have to do a bowel run before you start the procedure. Mm. You don't have to clean the bowel before that, which is not very pleasant for someone who's suffering from diarrhea in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting area of medicine. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. Again, I did a bit of looking up about FMT in preparation for the podcast. It's, if you look on the website for Bundesinstitut für Arzneimittel und Medizinprodukte, there's information there. Yeah, I found it astounding that the stool sample is really checked for so many pathogens, but also the blood of the donor is also checked for viruses. And then there's also a lot of exclusion criteria for a donor, which makes sense. Like, if you have a GI disease, you're obviously not allowed to then donate a stool sample. But there is also, like, you know, if you've had antibiotics in the last 3 months, again, makes sense, because your stool will be at higher risk of having C. diff in it already, for example. But yeah, very interesting area. I feel like we've covered a lot. I think important take-home messages. Number one, the name Clostridioides, we're not pronouncing it wrong. That's how it is now. But you can still call it Clostridian, or, you know, people are going to know what you're talking about. I think important to realize that it is or can be a very serious illness to get, especially in people with risk factors for a more severe infection. So the elderly, the immune suppressed, multimorbid patients. It's associated with antibiotic use. It's associated with the hospital. So having it in your differential diagnosis list when you are confronted with a patient who has, I want to say Durchfall, diarrhea. Something important as well is to, if there is an at-risk patient, just to treat them initially while you're waiting for the result of the stool sample. You can always cease the antibiotic. And obviously, don't forget the supportive measures such as fluids, such as total parenteral nutrition, if that's what's needed, and to keep checking bloods, checking for renal failure, and these kind of complications which can occur. And then, yeah, keeping it in mind, if you have a patient who has had a relapse, which may or may not respond to therapy, that there are alternatives, newer alternatives out there, such as the monoclonal antibody bezlotoxumab or an fecal microbiota transplant. So these are definitely interesting therapy options. Yes, is there anything I've forgotten or you feel like you've forgotten you wanted to add on?
I think it's a good model to tell us about the balance of the good and the bad bacteria in the gut, and how antibiotic treatment actually is a kind of terminal nuclear warfare against bacteria in your intestine. So it's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, we have antibiotics and we really like them because we've saved a lot of lives giving antibiotics. However, people might get at risk of getting C. diff infections undergoing antibiotic treatment. So I think that's intriguing and interesting in medicine and science to see that there's no such thing as good or bad, because there's a kind of balance between things. And this is a good model to see. They're doing one thing in one system, the system in their gut, the balance might shift to another side. And I think that's very fascinating.
Ah, on that note, you've made me think of another question. What about probiotics in the treatment or prevention of C. diff?
To my knowledge, there is very little evidence that any single probiotic is effective in the long term. There's been a number of studies done, and you actually need to treat a very, very large number of patients to see a clinical benefit. So it's probably not bad, but I guess you have to give probiotics to maybe 100 people to see a benefit, and 2 or 3 people who are at risk.
Okay.
So it's very weak evidence.
Okay.
Although we all love probiotics, don't we?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
The idea of doing something good by eating good food, eating good bugs is intriguing.
Well, I think that wraps it up. Thank you so much again for taking the time out of your busy schedule to share your knowledge with us. I really found it interesting and definitely helpful for my clinical practice. So thank you once again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Vielen Dank, dass du heute wieder zugehört hast und unser Gast gewesen bist. Wir hoffen sehr, dass dir dieser Beitrag gefallen hat und du etwas für deinen klinischen Alltag mitnehmen konntest. Wenn dem so sein sollte, dann freuen wir uns sehr über eine positive Bewertung bei Apple Podcasts. Falls du Lust hast mitzumachen und es einen Themenbereich gibt, in dem du dich besonders gut auskennst, dann melde dich doch gerne unter kontakt@klinisch-relevant.de. Gleiches gilt, wenn du Themenvorschläge oder konstruktive Kritik für uns hast. An dieser Stelle auch der Hinweis auf unseren Newsletter, den du unter www.klinisch-relevant.de abonnieren kannst und der dich immer auf dem Laufenden hält. Wenn du dich für unseren Newsletter einträgst, bekommst du einen 5-Euro-Gutschein, mit dem du in unserer Fortbildungsakademie einkaufen kannst. Wir wünschen dir jetzt bis zum nächsten Mal eine gute Zeit und freuen uns, wenn du bald wieder einschaltest. Pass auf dich auf, bleib gesund, bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.